Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details. With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
One of the most common myths about both these Boer wars is, oh, the British just wanted all the gold. They just wanted all the diamonds. And that is just wrong. Because the British were fighting for control, either in a conciliatory manner or militarily, for decades before even diamonds were discovered in South Africa. What the British wanted is they wanted a confederation that looked a little bit like what they had in Canada. The British wanted to have a monopoly on ports that led their route to India. So for decades and decades, the British tried to keep some kind of soft control or influence over the area just to make sure that nothing could disrupt their trade with India. And the British just wanted as little as possible to rock the boat in South Africa so that they could have free trade, quote unquote, that wasn't going to be disrupted by wars that would really sink the British treasury.
History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. The United States has spent the last couple of years dealing with a very painful reckoning of racial issues in its past. One nation that's arguably fraught with even more racial tension is South Africa. The reasons are extremely complicated, but much of it has to do with a series of settlements and wars that were fought over 100 years ago. And these wars, called the Boer Wars, still ripple South Africa today with their effects. These are two wars fought in the 1880s and the early 1900s between the British Empire and independent states in South Africa, inhabited by ethnic Dutch and others. But it's important to note that South Africa didn't become what it is today by accident, though Europeans did settle it by accident, at least at first. Over the 18th and 19th centuries, white settlements expanded intentionally across southern Africa, but chaotically as well. Well, these European settlers weren't the only ones expanding in southern Africa. The Zulu tribe also expanded and absorbed other tribal members whom they didn't annihilate. Many clashes between black tribes and white settlers broke out, and these clashes didn't follow racial lines, nor were they always over resources. Most of these clashes are largely forgotten, and even the so-called Boer War remains extremely misunderstood. Today's guest is Michael Buster. He's the host of the Forgotten Wars podcast, a more than 40-chapter podcast with the first season focusing exclusively on the Boer War and control over southern Africa. Some have mischaracterized the Anglo-Boer War as the British Empire's Vietnam, while others have drawn parallels between it and the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003. Some argue that it was simply a war over natural resources, over gold mines and diamond mines. And some have argued that the British invented concentration camps during the Second Boer War of 1899 to 1902. So there are a lot of things that we discuss in this episode. It's really not just about the Boer Wars, but about issues that were engulfing the globe during the 19th and 20th centuries, such as how the British botched abolition in the Cape Colony and sowed the seeds for many future wars, and attempts at abolition in South Africa are contrasted with the approach that Abraham Lincoln took to abolish slave states at State of the Union. We look at how the Boer Wars, interestingly enough, made Winston Churchill. He was in a POW camp, which He wrote accounts of this that led to lucrative book sales that helped him fund his first political campaign and win a seat in the House of Commons. We discuss whether the British really invented concentration camps during the Anglo-Boer War. And lastly, noting that the British won, how is it possible to win a war that's fought thousands of miles away from your motherland when, in most cases, this type of war is lost? The Revolutionary War, the Vietnam War, and other things like this. So this is a war that most people don't understand well, but has surprisingly large implications for the 20th and even the 21st centuries. So I hope you enjoyed this discussion with Michael Buster. Michael, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me, Scott.
When I was looking into this issue and the points that you made about the Boer War on your podcast, there were a lot of things that I never really thought about with South Africa, that it is very similar to the United States and it has a mixed race population. It dealt with some very painful growing pains of trying to integrate its population together. And it did some similar things as the United States, but also some very different things due to its native culture, due to its political circumstances of the time. And it's an interesting sort of test case to understand how these developments that we know well in the United States play out differently in other parts of the world. And with South Africa, in my mind, I think I just placed it as part of the general British Empire. And I knew that there are people who grew up there, like J.R.R. Tolkien, Charlize Theron is from South Africa, but didn't really think of it in terms of people who came there as settlers, but had lived there for so long that they really became part of the native population. But the differences were stark enough to cause conflict. So let's go back to the very beginning and open up what you went into in incredible depth on your podcast. So what is the beginning of South African history as you explore on your show and as we consider the Boer War, where white settlers initially end up there? So let's start there. That sounds good.
Great. So the Nieuwe Haarlem, this was a ship of the Dutch East India Company. And on March 25th, 1647, this ship went high and dry near a town called Blauwberg, just north of the Salt River. The crew members, though, were lucky enough that they escaped this shipwreck. But unfortunately, Leon Derrit Jantz and about 62 other crew members could not fit aboard another vessel that was going to make a return to the Netherlands. That's where the Dutch East India came from. So for a year, these 63 men waited at what we now call South Africa. They waited, and they were safely home a couple years later. And in a report to the Dutch East India Company, Jantz and his crew argued that they should put a permanent refreshment station where they crashed, ironically enough. The natives, they reported there, were peaceful and that the soil was actually good for harvesting crops and that they would actually have a shot at trading, which of course was what the Dutch East India Company was all about. So the Dutch East India Company approved that this little refreshment station would get set up. And so they sent three more ships in 1652. So originally, whites showed up here by accident. And when they showed up in a little bit more force aboard these three ships, it was just as a refreshment post, almost like a Gila Bend. I don't know how many listeners are from Arizona, but there's this little podunk town between Phoenix, Arizona and Yuma, Arizona. And that place gets millions of people passing through it each year. But I mean, it has just over 1,000 people living there, and it's nothing more than a place that people pass through. And that's all that this part of what we now call South Africa was for a time. It was just a place to pass through for the Dutch East India Company.
I think we'd be remiss to not talk about the condition of African tribal society. That would, I could hear some audience or some listeners tisking me for beginning the history just with a white settler showing up first. That, what, you don't think there was a history before? So in context of the African tribes who were there, what was the political situation at the time? And I wonder how much of exposure did they have to European explorers, European traders? Because going around the Horn of Africa is something that had already, even before the Dutch trading company had set up an outpost, had been happening for centuries with Vasco da Gama. So even if there wasn't a permanent settlement, I would imagine there would be some level of interaction, sort of in the way that on the Lewis and Clark expedition, they encountered some American Indians who spoke scattered bits of English due to interactions with British fishermen or other people who were on the Pacific coast. So what was the political situation at the time, and did they have much interaction with European traders beforehand?
That's an excellent question and a very fair question. Our answers to that question are a little bit harder to nail down just because of the records of what the situation was geopolitically before whites showed up isn't quite as systematic. But I'm going to answer that question in part by telling you about a force called Umfakane. The Zulu meaning for this word is the hammering or the crushing. And so what that means is a number of things. There were scores of African tribes in what we now call Southern Africa before any whites showed up. But during this time of Umfakane that was happening during the 1600s and 1700s and into the 1800s, were that a bunch of these smaller kingdoms started to consolidate into a few larger kingdoms. And as these kingdoms got larger, they started to focus more on improving their militaries and mobilizing more of their men to fight in a military. And so what this caused was a lot of tribes to flee when they were confronted by a much larger tribe. And let me tell you the story of Shaka Zulu. This might help your listeners put more of a face to this force that we're talking about. So I'm going to jump ahead about 100 years, but this is not like the only case of Umfakane. Shaka Zulu was born in 1787. And so his father was the chief of the Zulu. This tribe, when Shaka's father was in charge, had only 4,000 to 5,000 people that was in its confederation. Now Shaka, he was bullied and treated really terrible by older children. Part of it had to do with his questionable status as a member of his father's family. His father had many wives and mistresses, and Shaka was not the son of one of those higher tier wives, you could say. So Shaka would be bullied. Kids would make him catch boiling hot food in his hands. He would get mocked for, and hopefully this isn't too much for your listeners, for his small penis and his crinkled ears. And he would harbor a great hatred. But when he was 15 or 16, he gets initiated into this kind of military cadet school for 15 to 16 year olds. And he was a star kid. And after his father died, with a lot of murder and intrigue happening, Shaka managed to rise to the top of the Zulu. And he turned this confederation of tribes under Zulu control into something much more powerful, much more militant. And they took 100 chiefdoms, 100 different little kingdoms under their wing. The members who survived being taken under the Zulu wing were incorporated into the Zulu Confederation and its army. So to put it in another way, some of the first people that were already there before the Dutch East India showed up, they were referred to by whites, so probably not the perfect name for these people, were Bushmen. And they were believed to be some of the first human beings to ever have inhabited the earth in Africa, like were the direct ancestors of some of these Bushmen. So that was some of the people that the whites of like the very first refreshment post in Southern Africa ran into. But then they also ran into more and more tribes who were being pushed around by this force of Umfakane, by big tribes like the Zulu, who were getting more and more powerful.
So the history here, I think for those who haven't looked specifically at South Africa, gets a bit confusing. You have Dutch settlers first. One of the languages in South Africa is Afrikaans, which is a variation of Dutch. And I've read that when a person from the Netherlands speaks to somebody that speaks Afrikaans, they understand one another, but the language is in some senses more simple. And they'll use, interesting constructions in Afrikaans, where they might use a compound noun to describe something that's one noun in Dutch. But what happens with the evolution of the settlement of more Dutch merchants and later colonists, and then the British incursion as well?
Right. It's a pretty interesting story. And also, ironically, and kind of sort of an echo from something else that happened pretty close to home for us, was around religious freedom. Part of the people that came to Southern Africa came from France. They were French Huguenots. And after a Treaty of Avignon was signed in France, it promised that, hey, we're going to allow religious freedom here. But then the French government went back on that promise. So it sent a lot of Protestants, like the French Huguenots, into flight. So in addition to Dutch people starting to settle Southern Africa, you had some French Huguenots who decided they were going to find more freedom in this colony far, far away, like 9,000 miles away in Southern Africa. So you had a few hundred of those show up to Southern Africa. And so they would help develop the area. And then, of course, the British got involved with Southern Africa because they were looking for an intermediate station to their most prized colony. And that most prized colony was India. And so they also started to take interest in this area of Southern Africa. So you started to get some more British settlement in Southern Africa as well. So you started to have this cocktail, if you will, of French, Dutch, and British descendants descending on Southern Africa.
Do these communities remain, it appears that they remain more distinct than, say, a melting pot in the United States. Is that correct? And if so, what is the reason for that?
So the French and the Dutch settlers appear to have melded pretty well. They were able to own land. There weren't different rights for French people than there were for Dutch descendants. The British started to set up some settlements in Natal. That's also part of what we now call South Africa. And some of those became more distinctly English in their orientation. But that's not to say that they weren't sharing space with other Dutch descendants as well. But some of the earlier settlements, like the Huguenots and the Dutch, they definitely were more of a melting pot, creating kind of their own culture of farming. And those who worked for the Dutch East India Company for a time were able to eventually strike out on their own and start to own some of their own land. And then, of course, sadly enough, you start to see as their holdings grow, they decide, you know what, to do the really hard manual labor is something that's a little bit beneath us. So then they started to import slaves.
Well, then jumping ahead a few years, you point to one event that you say shapes the course of South African history, and that's a near-death experience of Paul Kruger. So what is this event? About what time does this take place, and how does this shape the history of South Africa?
So this event is, it is fascinating. And here's the interesting thing. The way that you would pronounce Kruger's name in Afrikaans is actually Kreer. Paul Kreer. So that took me some coaching from an Afrikaans-speaking friend. Paul Kreer would eventually become a four-time elected president of one of the republics that make up now present-day South Africa, and it was called the South African Republic, or also the Transvaal. He was elected president four times, and this guy was something else. In a lot of ways, he was ridiculously brave as a youth. Like, this guy would go into gunfire and be shouting orders, telling people where to go, even though he was standing where plenty of gunfire had taken down a bunch of his fellow soldiers. He got pretty wealthy. He was very religious, like a very literal kind of religious, to where he believed his interpretation of the Bible that still in 1900, he thought that the earth was flat. That was what his religious sect taught. So very interesting guy. But this guy might not have even made it into the 1890s if not for this event turning out in the most unlikely way. So I'm going to tell you about it from his lips. This happened in 1845 when he was on the hunt for elephants. So this will be from his lips. After about an hour's ride, I came across a rhinoceros and shot at it. But I only succeeded in wounding the animal, and it fled into the wood. I dismounted quickly, ready to shoot again, but moved only a few steps away from my horse, lest the rhinoceros should turn to attack me, in which case it would be necessary to remount at once. I succeeded in getting a second shot, but at that very moment, my rifle exploded just where I held it with my left hand and my left thumb. The lock and the ramrod lay before me on the ground, and the barrel of the gun behind me. I had no time to think, for the furious animal was almost upon me, so I jumped on my horse and galloped away as fast as I could with the rhinoceros in fierce pursuit, until we came to the ford of a little sprite, when my pursuer came to the ground and so allowed me to ride quietly in the direction of our wagons. During the next day, our people, guided by the track of my horse, went to the spot where they found the rhinoceros still alive and, following the trail of blood, discovered the remains of the rifle and my thumb. So this happened early 1800. This guy lost his thumb, and medicine, especially in southern Africa, wasn't exactly modern at that point. So this is how he decides to handle it. My hand was in a horrible state. The great veins were torn asunder and the muscles lay exposed, the flesh hanging in strips. I bled like a slaughtered calf. I had succeeded in tying a large pocket handkerchief round the wound while riding. When I got to the wagons, my wife and sister-in-law were sitting by the fire, and I went up to them laughing so as not to frighten them. My sister-in-law pointed to my hand, which looked like a great piece of raw meat. I called out to my wife to go to the wagon and fetch some turpentine. Then I asked my sister-in-law to take off my bandolier, and she saw that my hand was torn and noticed how white I was, for I had hardly any blood left in my body. I kept on renewing the turpentine bandages, for turpentine is a good remedy to burn the veins up, as the Boers would say, and thus to stop the bleeding. I sent my youngest brother to borrow as much turpentine as he could get from the nearest farm, which was about a half hour's ride away. Herman Poetheater came over with his brother. The former got into the wagon, and when he saw the wound, he cried out, "That hand will never heal. It is an awful wound." He had to get down again as quickly as possible, for he was nigh of fainting. But his brother said, possibly to comfort me, "Nonsense. I have seen worse wounds than that. Get plenty of turpentine." We drove to the farm. Everyone there advised me to send for a doctor and have the hand amputated, but I positively refused to allow myself to be still further mutilated of my own free will. The two joints of what once was my thumb had gone, but it appeared that it would be necessary to remove a piece of bone. So he eventually, Creer, takes his own pocket knife and he cuts the rest of his own thumb off. And then eventually what happens for Creer is a really interesting remedy. He decides that, hey, there is a remedy that we know amongst us Boers, where if you stick a infected limb or something that's been bleeding and infected for a while, if you stick it up inside of a sheep's guts, you will actually stem the infection. Because at this point, his arm was starting to change colors because of how bad the infection was. So Creer goes and finds a slaughtered sheep, or they slaughter a sheep, stuffs his hand up inside of the sheep. And the crazy thing is, this actually worked. The infection stops. And he says something that I just found hilarious. I mean, I'm no scientist or genius, but he says, yes, we think this stemmed the infection because the sheep feed on a particular herb nearby this river, which to my mind goes, why not go and get this herb and, you know, put it in some boiling water or something? Like, get the herb. Why do you got to go through all the steps of sticking your infected hand inside of a sheep? But hey, that's just me. Whatever the merits of the method, it worked. And if it hadn't worked, wow, South Africa's history could have been very different. There could have been no Boer War even or no South African War of 1899 to 1902.
It's interesting that personalities like that, that in, let's say, quote unquote, civilized society back in the motherland may not do as well. They may not seem a little bit too outlandish or eccentric to mingle among high society and find placement there. But in a more frontier type of setting, or when you have to improvise, jump headlong into situations that some would describe as recklessly, those qualities can make you do well there. So whether it's a conquistador, whether it's somebody operating on the frontier, it's interesting that you see qualities like that. And just to, so as we're going through the chronology here, he is a four-time president of Transvaal. Now, at this time, there are different states within South Africa. Before looking at the seeds of the Boer War and issues like British trying to abolish slavery, but it doesn't work as well in South Africa as it does in other parts of their empire, these different states, when are they consolidating? Do they maintain independence from one another throughout the 19th century, or are they all distinct at this time?
Yeah, they're all distinct. So let me paint a bit of a picture for you. There was the Cape Colony that turned into a British colony. There were two colonies north of the Cape Colony that eventually emerged. One was called the Orange Free State. That was a free Boer republic. And then the other colony alongside that Orange Free State was the Transvaal, also known as the South African Republic. That was also a Boer republic.
And by Boer, just for terminology, does that refer to ethnic Dutch people who are living in South Africa?
So the term originally referred just to farmers who emerged in the Cape Colony during the time of Dutch control. And eventually it became a term that, it referred mostly to Afrikaans descendants or to Dutch descendants who then, ended up speaking Afrikaans and living also in the Cape Colony and Natal, but they made up the majority of the Free State and the Transvaal.
Okay, so you mentioned, I think, three states there, and how many?
And then just to the north of those two Boer republics was another British colony of Natal. So those four colonies were independent of one another until after the South African War of 1899 to 1902 broke out.
Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino. With cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
They were some of the most powerful men who've ever lived. They waged war, forged peace, and altered the fates of billions of people. And yet, they were just as human, just as flawed as you and me. They were the presidents of the United States, and they are the subjects of the history podcast, This American President. In each episode of This American President, we explore how flawed men have managed this awesome responsibility. To listen now, go to ParthenonPodcast.com or search This American President on your favorite podcast platform.
Now, some of the issues that come up and affect South Africa directly, you note that the British botched their abolition of slavery in the Cape Colony and planted the seeds for many future wars. And for listeners, if they want to refer to this in more depth, a couple of years ago, I did a 5-part series on the history of slavery, basically from the ancient world to abolition. And in the case of the British Empire, the transatlantic slave trade is abolished, I think, 1807. Then slavery is, a few decades later, completely abolished throughout their empire. And it's a few decades later that it happens in the United States. But that makes it sound like everywhere in throughout Britain, it's just completely dropped when it's a much more piecemeal process. And Europeans are grappling with this in the 19th century. There are people like the famed missionary David Livingstone, who at least wants to attempt to do things like develop trade and commerce in Africa so that it can end the slave trade there internally on the continent. So there are some who are attempting to do this. And then, of course, there are others like King Leopold who are aggressively and ruthlessly exploiting slavery on the continent. But how does Britain attempt to affect abolition in the Cape Colony? And you notes that you can compare and contrast this with the approach Abraham Lincoln takes. So what does that all look like?
So the approach the British took might have made sense financially in the short term when they took this approach, but man, did it have terrible ripple effects. It's impossible to know what could have been, but here's what was. The British eventually said, okay, there will be no more slavery in the Cape Colony. And this was from like 1835 on, when they were really trying to enforce this. And they said, you can sell your slaves. We will compensate you for your slaves. But here was the catch. They were going to compensate far below the quote market value for a slave. And if you were wanting to get compensation for your slaves, you didn't just need to go to, say, Cape Town or somewhere relatively close by. You had to sail yourself all the way to London. That's about a 9,000 to 10,000 mile voyage. At that point in time, that's about a 4.5 month round trip to go and get your compensation, that again, below quote market value for your slaves. So this enraged a bunch of these Cape Colony residents who thought they were entitled to the full market value for their slaves and thought this was a pretty transparent attempt to rob them of value for their slaves. So what a lot of them decided to do was leave and immigrate further north, deeper into southern Africa. And that is where you got these two new republics that eventually became the Orange Free State and the Transvaal. Now, what I mentioned to you previously, Scott, was that when Abraham Lincoln was trying to consolidate as much support as he could against those Confederate states during the American Civil War, what he did in a state, say, like Maryland, that had a lot of slave owners in it, to keep them in the Union, he actually compensated slave owners in that state for their slaves as a way to make sure that he had their support. Now, of course, that didn't keep everybody who was a slave owner or a secessionist at heart from leaving Maryland. We know, of course, that some of them still went and took the Confederate side. But many of those in Maryland stayed with the Union. And I can't help thinking that was due in no small part to receiving compensation and not having to sail 9,000 miles to go get that compensation. And when you think about, you know, one of the advantages the Union had during the American Civil War, it was their numbers. And when you have a president make decisions like that, that must have been tough if a lot of your supporters think slavery is morally wrong and you're paying people for their slaves. But in the end, it helped the Union have its overwhelming numbers to help defeat the Confederacy. So I can't help wondering if the British had taken a similar approach in southern Africa, if they had compensated these slave owners in the Cape Colony for their slaves at the, quote, fair market value, and if they hadn't made them make a 4.5 month trip, would there have been these republics that emerged later on and ended up being embroiled in a war almost 100 years later?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very interesting what if. And it could have been an issue that maybe they would have wanted to do that, but they didn't have the resources or they didn't have the staffing to be able to send people to South Africa. So they thought, well, we'll just do it this way and not really consider the implications that few people are going to take such a long voyage that whatever price they could get for their slaves would almost certainly not make up for the trip itself. But we don't know. I mean, that's a very interesting question. So, but as you state, what does happen is it doesn't work. It creates these new republics, and then there's already this internal tension.
One thing I'll add, Scott, is, yeah, I don't know the answers to all those questions, but I can definitely tell you that it wasn't so much a staffing issue. It was definitely the money issue. And the reason I stress this is there was a similar decision in the around 1870, where the British actually got an offer from the Orange Free State to actually be incorporated back into the British colonies, but to be annexed basically by the Cape Colony. But at that point, the British decided, no, this would be too expensive. And so they didn't incorporate the Orange Free State because it would have been too expensive, which if they, again, I'm not facing the tough decisions those British parliamentarians were facing, but if they had made the decision to keep the Orange Free State, it would have been three, you know, colonies against one republic, the Transvaal, which who knows if there would have even been a Boer War if the Transvaal had no ally when that war broke out.
So now looking at some of the central figures in the Boer War, one of them is Cecil Rhodes. Who is he and how did he get his start?
Boy, this guy is fascinating. And of course, somebody that I think many of us love to dislike, and completely rightfully so in certain respects. So some interesting things about this guy. I don't think a lot of people focus on his early childhood, but he was a middle child who was also treated a bit like an oldest child just because of the distance in age he had between he and other kids. So he had to develop the skills of a middle child who has to be a bit more of a negotiator and deal with more powerful people around him. But he also gained the confidence that a lot of oldest children get, of just that attitude of, I can take on the world, by having his mom's undivided attention for 4 years. I'm not going to spend too much time on that, but I think that really did have a lot of influence on how he grew up. And then the other thing that could have been different, his father was an Anglican priest and sounded like a very kind and caring priest, but a very distant, cold father figure. And so what a lot of people in Cecil's family hoped is that he would become a priest, but Cecil was not interested in becoming a priest. He wanted to be an attorney, actually. But then Cecil's older brother goes to Southern Africa, to that British colony of Natal, because he wanted to get rich in cotton farming. And so Cecil eventually follows him at age 17. He makes this 72-day voyage to be with his brother. And this was in 1870. And so he arrives there, starts farming cotton. His brother then decides, you know what, I want to get rich, because diamond mining was just starting to pop up there. And at first Cecil says, I'm going to resist these easy, quick riches of diamonds. I'm going to stay and work the cotton. And he was actually an excellent cotton foreman, as it turned out, and actually treated his African native laborers remarkably well, paid them well, lent them money, all that stuff. And he did that for a time very successfully, but eventually he just couldn't stay away from the diamond fields. So he eventually went to work in those diamond fields before the age of 20. So as a businessman, what Cecil was really good at was not only making smart business decisions. At first, it was selling ice to people who were working the diamond mines. But eventually, he found other, I guess you would say, strong entrepreneurs who he befriended and was able to network with and work with, and ended up going into business with a lot of them. And what they quickly identified is that to do diamond mining, it does not make sense to try to do your own little small operation. It's just the economies of scale do not work for that. So he and his network of friends were able to buy lots and lots of claims where diamond mining was happening. And eventually they found their way to being the monopoly. Their De Beers company had a monopoly on diamond mining, which, as we know still today, if you're just cranking out diamonds as soon as you get your hands on them, they're going to lose some of their value because they won't be as precious and rare anymore. But once these guys had their monopoly, they were able to dictate to some level what the supply was of diamonds and therefore the price. So he got really rich that way. And eventually he rose through the ranks of the Cape Colony Society and eventually got elected to Parliament in the Cape Colony and was very effective as a politician in the Cape Parliament, eventually became Prime Minister. Now, all this in the meanwhile, he's running his different companies, one of them being the British South African Company, trying to get more land so where he can find more diamonds and eventually more gold, because gold started to become a thing. So he used his positions in government to not only find more land, but also these were not great conditions to work in diamond mines and eventually gold mines. So he and many other Cape Colony politicians tried to do whatever they could to marginalize any African native landowners as much as possible. They made it more and more difficult for these people to own land so that they couldn't just farm and, you know, be economically independent. They wanted to make these blacks dependent wage laborers. And so he was very effective at doing that, passed the Glenn Gray Act. That was a huge part of it. And this guy was just successful at almost everything he put his hands on for the very first 3 to 4 decades of his very short life. But then he ran into the Transvaal, the South African Republic, into President Kriel and his regime. And that's when Cecil started to meet resistance for his grand ideas to kind of have that Cape to Cairo railroad, to have more and more of Africa made in the British Empire's image. He was not getting his way every time he went toe-to-toe with Paul Kriel and the Transvaal.
So this takes us to the First Boer War, the British and the Boers of the Transvaal fight, and including British-friendly Federation of South African States. But you know it's not for gold or diamonds. So what happens to cause the First Boer War?
And I appreciate you saying that. I'm just going to say it again for listeners. One of the most common myths about both these Boer Wars is, oh, the British just wanted all the gold. They just wanted all the diamonds. And that is just wrong. Because the British were fighting for control, either in a conciliatory manner or militarily, for decades before even diamonds were discovered in South Africa. What the British wanted is they wanted a confederation that looked a little bit like what they had in Canada. And so to give you more context on why they wanted something set up kind of like Canada, you need to first understand kind of what I mentioned before. They wanted a naval base at Simonstown that could be really firmly protected. And they were afraid of France and the Netherlands of controlling some of the ports around South Africa. And then the British wanted to have a monopoly on ports that led their route to India. So for decades and decades, the British tried to keep some kind of soft control or influence over the area. And just to make sure that nothing could disrupt their trade with India. And they eventually wanted to convince the Transvaal and the Orange Free State to form a South African Confederation that wouldn't keep getting into wars with neighboring tribes, because war costs money. And when some of these wars reached a crisis level, the British would have to send troops to help fight in these wars against tribes that opposed these different Boer or British settlers. And the British just wanted as little as possible to rock the boat in South Africa so that they could have free trade, quote unquote, with South Africa and a steady flow of trade that wasn't going to be disrupted by wars that would really sink the British treasury.
Yeah, and this also is taking place at the absolute height of European colonization from the 1870s up to World War I. There's a period called the Scramble for Africa, where different European empires are trying to take large parts of Africa out to set up their own colonies, to provide enough resources to enrich them. Because really, up until the post-World War II period, one of the dominant economic ideas is that if you are reliant upon trade with other states for your resources, you essentially make yourself vulnerable. However, if your resources come from a colony in which you control, then you're independent. This gives you a much stronger position of bargaining. You can fund your military machines. You're commercially in a much safer place, which we now, economists argue, that is not the case whatsoever, but that was at least the conventional wisdom at the time. So at this time, I mean, it's just understood that all these great powers are trying to secure their colonies. And there's, I don't think hardly any part of Africa that isn't under some European control. The only exceptions I can really think of are maybe Ethiopia and Liberia. Liberia definitely has the legacy of Western influence there as a former slave post. So this is when it begins. So tell me about some of the figures on both sides. You note the broken but brave men who lead the British effort, and who are those on the other side? So tell me about some of these figures.
Some of the figures on the British side, you said?
Yeah, who lead the British war effort, and then also on the Boer side.
Okay, so it's really fascinating and sometimes comical, but not in any disrespect to the men who led on the British side. So during especially the lead up to the First Boer War and then afterwards, you had leaders of two different rings within the British military. That's probably something I should set some context with. You had the India ring, and that was led by Field Marshal Roberts. He would become Field Marshal during the South African War. So he, in India, did what we now call India, anyway, led some British expeditions against tribes that were not going to take what the British wanted to do in the area lying down. So he led some different sieges and battles in there and was very successful. And what he did to help keep that success going was have a sort of ring of officers that he kept going to over and over again wherever he waged war on behalf of the British Empire. And the advantage to being in that ring is that you probably got more recognition, you got more promotions and prestige. Now, there was a ring before that set up by Sir Garnet Wolseley, and a lot of people called that ring the Africa Ring or the Ashanti Ring. He fought in Ashanti Wars, among many other wars, and he had all his hand-picked officers that he liked to take wherever he went and waged war on behalf of the British Empire. So the kind of crazy thing is both these guys ended up being blind in one eye. Roberts got blind in one eye because of brain fever he suffered as a child. Sir Garnet Wolseley got blinded in one eye because of a wound he sustained during one of the wars that he fought in. And then on top of that, one of the officers that rose up inside of Wolseley's ring, the Africa Ring, was a young Sir Redvers Buller. This guy, in his early 20s, while working with a horse within the British military, somehow this horse just lost it and ended up kicking Buller in the face, knocking out the front middle teeth of his, so that for the rest of his career, he spoke with a lisp. So you got two blind guys at the top of these two military rings in the British Army, and then one of the biggest lieutenants, you could say, of the Africa Ring, of Wolseley's ring, was a guy who was now talking with the lisp. But don't take their infirmities to mean, oh, these were feeble men. These guys were epic, brave, recklessly brave, even by our standards. And they would end up having a huge hand in how the British waged war during this Boer War of 1899 to 1902.
And who replaced the commanders on the Boer side? Who are the leaders there?
So the original leaders, you had Pete Cronier. He led most of the war effort for the Boer Republics on the Western Front. So when they tried to drive into the Cape Colony, Pete Cronier was leading that effort. And he was not a remarkable military man, at least relative to the others that would replace him. He had his position because he was in good with Paul Kruger, the president of the Transvaal. And that happened far too much. Just men who were in high command in the Boer military because of their connections. So there was Piet Cronier leading that front. And then there was another Piet, a Piet Joubert, who led the Boer Republic's war effort on the Eastern Front, where they were driving into the colony of Natal to start the war. And he served pretty ably in the previous Boer War that was from 1880 to 1881. But he was no military genius, not even by his own account. He actually didn't think he was a very good general, said that about himself. But both these guys lacked the sustained aggression that the Boers really needed in order to take advantage of the 10-to-1 advantage they had in numbers at the very beginning of this war. Now, of course, as it really got going, that advantage vanished very quickly as the British started to land troops when it was clear, oh, this war is serious. But those were the two leading the war effort. But eventually, necessity basically got rid of these two guys at the top, even though if the Boers had really been playing their cards right, they would have seen pretty early on that these guys were not fit to be leading the kind of war that they needed to be fighting. So some of the men that replaced these leaders was, so a protege of Piet Joubert, you could say, was a young man named Louis Botha. Now, Botha, man, he is a fascinating character, much beloved by many South Africans. He was 37 years old at the time, 6 foot, broad-shouldered, really tightly trimmed beard. He was a descendant of those Huguenots who first immigrated to the Cape Colony after losing their religious freedom in France. So he grows up one of 13 children. And where he grew up, not only was he fluent in Afrikaans, not only was he able to speak English, but he actually spoke Zulu and Sotho languages. So the languages of some of the tribes nearby. As soon as he was a child, he was able to fire a rifle. And he actually fought alongside some Zulu tribes. And then when circumstances changed, he fought against some Zulu tribes as a relatively young kid. For example, he fought as part of a Boer commando in 1884 that helped establish Dini Zulu as the new king of the Zulu at that point in time. So eventually, he serves in the Transvaal Volksraad. Now, you could say the irony for this guy who was a much more able commander than Piet Joubert. The irony was that Louis Botha was a part of the Transvaal's Volksraad, which was like their Congress, if you want to put it in American layman terms. He served on there, and he was a part of the contingent that thought they should wait a lot longer to see if there was any way to avoid fighting the British in this Boer War of 1899 to 1902. He and a number of other members did that. But when basically events and some decisions made by men above his rank were made, Botha joined the war effort, and he ended up being much more effective and aggressive than Piet Joubert. One example, kind of a epic thing that Botha did is he built fortifications near the Tugela River for one of these battles. And what they did is instead of building fortifications where the British expected them behind this particular river, like further away from the British, they actually built these fortifications in front of the river. And this really threw off the British because they didn't have very good scouting. And eventually they early on in a particular battle got mowed down because of completely miscalculating where Botha would have dug trenches. And these innovations were just not things that Joubert was employing as much when he was fighting as general. So there's Louis Botha, somebody who was a very innovative commander and got really good at moving very quickly when needed, rather than just, okay, we'll put this town to siege and sit here and wait for them to surrender. That was not Botha's style at all. Another commander that emerged taking Piet Cronier's place was a Christian de Wet. And he was a epic commander, also one that would go down in, if you were to have an top 100 military commanders, I bet a lot of people would nominate De Wet. He was an excellent guerrilla warrior. He was an excellent mover of troops and almost changed the course of a particular battle that kind of put a nail in the coffin of the Boers winning a quick, easy victory, and that was the Battle of Paardeberg. De Wet was moving just 1,500 men against this colossal army of about 40,000 British men that just weren't being deployed quite as lightly as De Wet. But again, like I said, there was Pete Cronier that was leading that effort, and because of how feebly he led his forces, they eventually ended up surrendering, all 4,000 plus of them, to the British, whereas it could have been very different if De Wet had been in charge. And then I think the one that might be the most interesting to me is Jan Smuts. This guy was described by his professors, or at least one of his professors at the University of Oxford, where he went at the age of 17, as one of the two most brilliant students they had ever had, that they had ever seen. And then he came back to the Cape Colony to try to practice law. And then he tried to become a professor, but just couldn't break in as a professor. And it's just crazy to imagine the other what ifs. What if he had become a professor instead of having to hustle a little bit more and eventually finding his way into the Transvaal and eventually becoming the state attorney for the Transvaal, almost like the attorney general for the Transvaal. So becoming one of Cronier's right-hand men at age 28. And then when the South African War breaks out from 1899 to 1902, Jan Smuts eventually leaves behind his desk where he's acting as state attorney, and he eventually starts leading his own commando. And to be clear, commandos were groups of Boer warriors, typically in the scores of men, maybe in the hundreds of men. So he would eventually lead his own commando in a couple of attempts to drive into the Cape Colony and cause more Boers to rise up inside the Cape Colony. Because like I said before, especially the Cape Colony was a mix of British and Boers. So Jan Smuts would end up going and leading men into battle when before you would have pegged him as, oh, this guy will just be an academic stud who just keeps his nose in books or his feet inside of a courtroom.
Hey everyone, Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors.
Well, there's a lot of implications of the Boer War. We can talk about it, mentioning Winston Churchill, the possible invention of concentration camps and other things too. But just very briefly, without getting all to the minutiae of the different battles, how did the British win? Because this type of war is almost always lost by the army who is fighting it very far from their base of operations. The British lose the Revolutionary War. America's loss in Vietnam. We're seeing things unfold right now in Afghanistan. It's a natural disadvantage to fight a war against locals and natives on their own soil, yet the British win. So what do you think are the factors that allow the British to win the Anglo-Boer War?
It's a great question, because they, you know, had clashed with these Boers about 20 years before in the First Boer War and limped away, basically letting the Boers have their independence again in the Transvaal, and felt very humiliated after that fact. But that's not to say that they couldn't have beaten the Boers then, but the cost comes up again here, was more than the Gladstone ministry of the British Empire was willing to shoulder. So eventually, after just a few months, they gave up in that war. When this war rolls around 18 years later, there are some veterans on both sides, but British veterans who are thinking, never again will we have another Machuba. This was an infamous battle that ended in a humiliating British defeat in the First Boer War. And a lot of them thought, we are not going to lose our commitment or resolve if we fight these Boers again. So this time, the ministry that was in charge was the Salisbury ministry, from the more conservative party in Great Britain. And at that point in time, they made the determination that we cannot afford to let these Boers continue to do what they want in their republics. We cannot afford to wait for South Africa to become what we want it to be just by some natural flow of events. We have to make it happen. And so once they started that, they weren't prepared at the beginning, mind you. They had only a handful, like several thousand troops in South Africa at the beginning. That was it. But once the British set their minds to it, they poured a 250,000 plus troops into South Africa to win this war. Whereas the Boers were not even able to field anywhere close to even 80,000 troops. So I would say the biggest thing that helped the British win this war was just commitment and having sheer numbers that could easily be replaced relative to the smaller numbers that the Boers had.
And another thing, too, that to not leave out is you note that people have been fighting over the name of this war for a long time due to the tens of thousands of Black Africans who are involved. It is, of course, not simply Boers and British soldiers fighting each other, but it's the locals on the ground who live there. So how are they involved and how does this affect the naming convention of the war?
It's an excellent question. First, this war was called the Boer War by many historians. And then eventually they went more inclusive and they said, well, we should call this the Anglo-Boer War to include both the British and the Boers. But eventually more recognition was given to the fact that tens of thousands of Black Africans fought in this war, mostly on the British side. At first, they were technically not allowed to do this. This was supposed to be a, quote, white man's war, because both sides argued, oh, this is dishonorable to have Africans fighting on our side. So the Blacks were only allowed to serve more assisting type roles. But as the war progressed, both sides broke this rule pretty repeatedly, but it was much more to the British advantage that they were breaking it, because African natives saw more hope for their long-term future if the British won this war, rather than having a Boer-dominated Southern Africa. So you had tens of thousands of Africans supplying the British, either with horses or oxen, or they're just themselves as guards of various stations, or eventually of blockhouses that popped up all over South Africa to help suffocate the Boer war effort. And if you want to talk about people who died in really large numbers in these concentration camps, Blacks suffered dramatically in these concentration camps that came up.
Well, that's a good point, too, because some point to this war as the invention of concentration camps. So is that true? What happens during this war and what are these camps?
I'm glad we're addressing this, because this is more than anything. When I hear people talk about this war in passing, they say, oh, this is the one where the British invented concentration camps. And let me tell you, I just cannot be further from the truth. They did. Concentration camps did emerge, killed far more Boers than in these camps than on the field. So they were definitely a huge factor. They were insanely inhumane. One lady from the British Empire, Emily Hobhouse, went to observe these camps and report on these camps and bring attention to them. And one example of just how nasty these got was at a railway station, I believe it was Mafeking. There were a bunch of Boers that the British had kind of rounded up and were going to be placing in a camp eventually. But Hobhouse passes through this railway station to another camp to report on what's going on at that camp, and then comes back weeks later, and there are still these same Boers that she saw at the railway station waiting to be placed. And they're not well provisioned. They're just out there facing the elements. And this part just kills me, Scott, as somebody with a 9-month-old baby now. She saw a pregnant mother who also had a child that she was hoping to breastfeed. But this poor mother was so starved from the time that she was just waiting at the station to even be placed at a crappy camp, that Emily Hobhouse sat with this mother as her baby died in the mother's arms. because the mom was not able to feed the baby anymore. And there are just a bunch of heartbreaking stories like that for people waiting to be placed in these camps, people living in the camps. They were terrible. So that's kind of a long-winded way to answer your question. These were not the first concentration camps. In the 1870s, the Spanish actually set up reconcentration camps in Cuba when they were fighting against Cuban rebels who wanted their freedom. They created zones where people who were sympathetic to the Spanish could live, and then anything outside those zones was going to get torched by the Spanish troops. And in theory, the Spanish should have been, okay, you're friendly to us, you're living in our camps, we'll take care of you. But the reality was the camp conditions were really terrible, where they concentrated or reconcentrated all these people that were supposedly friendly to them. So that was the first emergence of that. And then in the earlier 1890s, the mid-1890s, the Cuban rebels rose up again against the Spanish. And there was this horrible general whose name came up a lot during the Boer War, General Viler, a Spanish general who was willing to do whatever it took to defeat these Cuban rebels. And he went about setting up these reconcentration zones so much more savagely, and they killed far more people in these reconcentration zones than even Boers who died in these concentration camps during the Boer War. There's a lot more I could say, a lot more stories I could go to, but I don't know how much depth you need on that question.
Well, I think this raises an interesting question, and this is a big question of military history, and that is, how do you win a war that's fought far from your homeland, that's fought overseas? Because I mentioned earlier that most of the time, these don't work. And using methods where you have to try to isolate different groups of people, put them in camps, as you mentioned, it almost always has the effect of angering locals, and you're simply recruiting more to the rebel side or the opposing army side. And Dan Carlin had a whole episode on the Spanish-American War that, as you mentioned, Spain is using heavy-handed tactics on locals in the Caribbean and other islands, causing them to rebel against them. As America fights Spain, many locals are on the American side. But when America takes the Philippines as its colony, it uses many of the same methods, and then locals turn against them as well. So I suppose, how do the British succeed in a way that many others have failed of fighting a war far from home? Is it because they adequately funded it? They had the favor of many of the locals on their side so that Black Africans were provisioning them against the Boers? What would you isolate for the reasons that the British won in a scenario where many others have lost?
Part of it goes back to that commitment word that I gave you. Commitment in numbers was a huge part of it. But yes, that doesn't always guarantee victory. The other factor that you could argue is that about, you could say, 10 to 20% at least of Boers actually ended up taking the British side as the war went on. So I mentioned that General Christian de Wet, who was an excellent guerrilla warrior. His brother actually was one of a handful of Boer military leaders who eventually saw that this is hopeless. This is going to burn our country to the ground and not lead to victory. So a lot of those people took the British side. They were referred to derogatorily as hands-uppers, people who surrendered and took the British side. So there was a significant contingent of those people who helped the British in terms of scouting and numbers. They were even allowed to fight against their own Boers in battles at times. And that really turned the war even more so against the Boers, who were often referred to towards the end as bitter enders, who just wouldn't give up. They were going to fight to the bitter end. Huh. So that would be one factor. And then the British, definitely in a decisive way, they burned so much of the Boer colonies to the ground in the Free State, and especially, well, also in the Transvaal. They were burning these areas to the ground. So there was just nowhere for people to survive and help supply the Boer warriors who were still in the field. And like I said before, there were more Boers who died in these concentration camps than even Boer warriors who were fighting in the field. And a lot of these warriors were embittered so much by these concentration camps that they said, you know, we're just going to fight to the end. How dare you do this to our women and children? We'll make you pay for this. But there were others who just thought to themselves, how much longer can I make my wife and seven children live in a camp like that? How much longer is this worth it when our odds are continuing to shrink or disappear, our odds of victory?
Well, before we get into the legacy of the Boer War, when people hear about this, oftentimes it's in passing. The Boer War, I mean, in the context of the biography of Winston Churchill. And that's how I encounter this war in any sort of detail first, was by reading about his life. In fact, many people don't really look at South African history very much, I suppose, pre-apartheid, except in the context of Winston Churchill, because he cast such a large shadow. So some people say that it made Winston Churchill, this war did. What was he doing at this time? What was his involvement and how did it influence his life?
So Winston Churchill at this point was starting to really starting to make his destiny. He was really young. I mean, 24 years old when this war broke out, but he had already been chasing danger for years before that, whether it was in present day India, where he would fight and just run through bullets to kind of prove himself as a leader and as a brave person. But he also would report on those things and write books about those things to help make some of his own money. He eventually, his mother worked some connections so that he could travel to the Cape Colony aboard the same ship that was bearing Sir Redvers Buller, the man who led the British war effort in South Africa for the first portion of the war. And here's the crazy thing. Churchill gets to the Cape Colony, and somehow he gets to find his way into this meal at Sir Alfred Milner, who was the British High Commissioner of the Cape Colony and Southern Africa at that point. And he was at this meal where Sir Alfred Milner was talking about what was going on and how the war wasn't going well those first few weeks for the British. And Buller was there as well. And at some point, Churchill, age 24, you know, never served more than a lieutenant in any military role and just a reporter, he starts talking to Milner about how he should be running this war and to Buller about mistakes that the British are making running this war. And at one point, Buller, not really one to mince words, just tells Churchill, don't be an ass. And that, you could say, was the end of that conversation. But for many of you who know Churchill, it didn't really take, authority figures didn't necessarily intimidate him into being silent or putting a cap on his bravery. Eventually, Churchill is aboard an armored train to report more on what's happening in Natal. And what happens is that Louis Botha and a contingent of Boers put a whole bunch of boulders in the path of this armored train that Churchill is on. And so it causes the train to go into a grinding halt. Some gunfire ensues. Churchill's running around trying to assist the British on this train in resisting the Boer attackers. But event and also assisting, trying to get a way for this train to get out of the situation, even if it had to go backward. They just wanted to get out of there. So eventually they get the train back on track and out of the situation. But then Churchill dismounts the train at a nearby town, but then he gets captured. And he might have gone down in flames because he reached for his pistol at that point, but it was not there. So he eventually decided, I should just be captured. So he became a POW for many weeks and just wouldn't give up on trying to find a way to escape this camp, even if he had to crash other people's escape attempts or meetings where they planned escape attempts. Churchill was not going to be denied escape from this place. It was actually only a matter of days before all of his family connections were going to get him passage from this camp with Boer permission, but Churchill didn't know that. So he made an escape one night and eventually found his way back into British hands. and safety and got back to England, but didn't stay there. He decides, I'm going to come back. So he comes back as a reporter and an officer, so kind of a dual role. So he would report on what was happening in some battles, and then in one battle, he actually delivered news to try to get one British officer to stop from surrendering, but was too late to do that. And because of just all that Churchill really lived through and did during this war, he wrote a couple books about these wars. And those books sold really, really well to where he could finally afford to run for the House of Commons. And when he got back to England, he also was seen in much higher regard for his bravery. And he also even toured the United States and even had Mark Twain actually introduce him at one of the speaking engagements that he had where Churchill was promoting his book. But after all that brave, reckless antics of his, after all of that making money from books, Churchill had the money, he had the prestige, and he won his first House of Commons seat and didn't really look back from there.
Yeah, and he appears all over the place. He's in World War I, one of the leaders of the Gallipoli campaign. The rest is history, as they say. So this comes to a big question, and I think something that you are addressing on your podcast, and listeners can listen to that series to get into incredibly more depth on this topic. And that is, what is a legacy of the Boer War? And you've debunked a few of the characterizations that it was over resources, that this is the invention of the concentration camp. And when people hear that word, they immediately think of the Holocaust. So we discussed that, but do you see parallels with this war to other wars? Some had characterize it as the British Vietnam or the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003. So how do you characterize this war? And in South Africa's history, what do you think is the legacy of this war?
It's really, sadly, Scott, it's a tragic legacy. I don't really think there's much, at least from my standpoint, positive to say about it, because a lot of the Africans who took the British side during this war, they were hoping, hey, maybe we'll get more access to property and not just have to be really lowly paid wage slaves. Hey, maybe we'll even get the vote. That's what the British values, at least as stated by politicians like Joseph Chamberlain. That's what they argued for. But that was not ultimately what happened for the Black Africans who served. The British made the decision that in order for this new United South Africa, and that wasn't immediately after the war, to be clear, but this new United South Africa to move forward, they had to make sure that whites were united and Black rights be damned. They prioritized making sure that whites were united, and they didn't think they would be able to sell so many of the Boers who survived this war on a United South Africa if Blacks were given the franchise. So that was a very problematic moral decision, in my view, that rippled decades and decades into the future. Basically, the idea was, hey, we won't even touch the Black franchise issue until South Africa is its own free country again, which most people at that point knew, well, when it's its own free country again, there's very little chance that they're going to turn and give rights to Africans who far outnumber whites in this country. So that's one legacy, is that Black Africans just got really screwed. Another legacy of the war is that the Boers sure didn't forget about these concentration camps. Quite understandably, these were brought up over and over again when the British would make any kind of complaints about how things were running. The Boers, all they had to do was turn and say, don't even talk to us. You put thousands of our women and children in concentration camps to die. So the legacy of concentration camps really gave a lot of fuel for various Boers or Afrikaners who wanted to run the country the way they wanted to run the country. And I guess another legacy that's a bit of a false one is that the Brits were kind of seen as the bad guys, the one aggressor in this war, that it was these Boers who were freedom fighters, just fighting for their republic's freedom, and along came these British bullies. And the British were very disingenuous and inconsistent in how they argued and rationalized their right to go in and dictate the way these republics were going to be run. It's not like these republics were just sitting there focusing inward, trying to make their countries great countries again. The Transvaal particularly, but not only Transvaal, were almost constantly expanding and trying to beat nearby tribes into submission or coerce nearby tribes into submission and take more territory to grow their republic. And that's part of what gave the British more ammunition to come after, particularly the Transvaal, was it was definitely an aggressive little republic.
Well, as you describe here, the effects of a war that happened over a century ago can have long-lasting impact, and the process of decolonization, once the colony ends and independence is granted, that does not end the story. There are many legacies left over, and we clearly see that in the story of South Africa. Well, this is just one war, and you went into this in incredible detail on your show, Forgotten Wars. And for listeners who want to check that out, there are many other things like this they can listen to. So, Michael, thank you for joining us. And where is the best place for people to find you online?
You can find me at my website, ForgottenWarsPodcast.com. And then you can find my podcast on pretty much any podcast provider there is out there. If you go to my website, you can also contact me with any questions that you have about the show as you're listening to the show.
All right. Well, people can check that out there, that link, and appreciate you sharing all of your info with us.
All right. Thanks so much for your time, Scott.
All right. That is all for today. If you'd like to see show notes for this episode and all my other episodes, go to ParthenonPodcast.com. That's the name of the podcast network that this show is a part of, along with other great history shows like Steve Guerra's Beyond the Big Screen and History of the Papacy, James Early's Key Battles of American History, and other shows as well. If you'd like to support this show, there are two easy ways to do so. The first is to subscribe to History Unplugged on the podcast player of your choice and leave a review. The second thing is to join the show's membership program. It's on Patreon, and if you go to patreon.com/unplugged and join it, as a member, you'll get completely ad-free episodes of the show's entire back catalog, which is 600 episodes and growing. Just go to patreon.com/unplugged. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next time.